Good evening. My name's Mike. I have been coming to this church for a long time. I can't remember how long. Let me just get my notes. About 10 years, 11 years maybe. Anyway, a long time. If you don't know me, what can I tell you? I'm a Watford fan, and I've got two little kids and family. Gosh, you all look bored already. I won't say anymore. Any other Watford fans, by the way? I'm trying to find. You? What do you mean you were? Okay. Right. I may no longer come to this church now, after that news. Anyway, anyone else? No? I'm trying to find another Watford fan in the vicinity. It's tough. Premier League, here we come. Anyway, most of you are continuing to switch off. Anyone stay up for the election Thursday till what sort of time? I did till 3 o'clock. Anyone beat that? Yeah, 5. Wow, impressive. I won't give away my political persuasion in case that influences whether you listen to me at all, so I won't admit that I was sobbing into my pillow at 3 o'clock. Oh yes, that's right, you've already voted, I can't influence you. And I could have been sobbing because I was so elated, of course. Maybe. But I did feel really sorry for Nick Clegg. It wasn't that I voted Lib Dem. Well, no one did, that was a problem, wasn't it? But I did feel really sorry for the Lib Dems, actually. And, you know, they were trying to do what was right for the country, and they all, you know, all these MPs who'd given up, you know, they get paid quite well, don't they? But all these MPs that, you know, their lifetime's work, Simon Hughes and Vince Cable voted out on Thursday night, I did feel sorry for them. And it was interesting, Nick Clegg was talking on Friday in his resignation speech, and he talked about how liberalism had been beaten by the politics of fear. And there was quite a lot of talk of fear in the whole run-up to the election. There was lots of fear of foreigners was being floated about. Fear of a poor health service. Careful, if you don't vote for us, your health service will come tumbling down. There's fear of terrorism. There was lots of talk of fear. And actually, tonight we're going to be looking at a fear which can cause us individually problems. And it's one that we can easily go throughout life without really acknowledging is even there. And no one else may notice it, but deep down we know it. And that fear I'm talking about is the fear that we sometimes feel of what might happen if we actually did what God called us to do. The fear of God's call on our lives. Because I really believe God's a radical God. He asks us to bring his kingdom into our communities. He's commissioned us to make disciples of all nations. He's challenged us to love those who live around us as much as we love ourselves. And he's asked us to follow him. And sometimes we're afraid that God is asking us to do something which seems to be very risky, and we don't like taking risks. It may feel that he's asking us to lose some of our security, our money, our salary that comes in, our home we live in, or that we may be so fearful that what he's calling us to do is so unlikely to bear fruit that people are going to laugh at us. We're afraid of what people may say. We may be worried that we're going to look foolish. We may be worried we're going to lose friends or family. Or more likely, it's something which is not as drastic as any of those things. But we know that despite God calling us to do something, maybe with our priorities, our money, our time, we haven't done it because, let's admit it, we're afraid. So instead, the easy option is not to do it at all, and we try and ignore it and pretend we don't even know that God has called us to do that particular thing. And it's a bit like when we pretend we're not afraid of something. And for me, at the moment, that is spiders, because I'm terrified of spiders, and I've now got two little kids, and I've got to try and pretend to them that I'm not, because otherwise you pass on your fear, and also, as the dad, you don't want to look a wimp to your kids. And so I'm really struggling with it, and so, you know, you approach the spider, and all calm, look, don't worry, I'm going to deal with this, and then it moves, and I run out of the room shrieking. Spiders, right, people tell me that it's irrational, the fear of spiders, but it is not, because I know they don't bite you in this country, but I have written off a car because of a spider. Genuine story, a little spider, it was quite a little one, came down while I was driving along, and I was so freaked out, I drove into a parked van, and I wrote off my car. I was fine. But I must admit, when the police turned up and they said, what's happened? I didn't admit about the spider. I just said, I just drove into the van. Of course. Anyway, sorry, I wasn't meant to tell that story. But back to the subject. Fear of God's call on our lives. Fear of what God has asked us to do. And maybe already, as I've just been saying that, there's something that's nagging at you. And I must admit, I've been reminded as I prepare this talk of several things that I've tried to block out. And there's so many reasons that we find to avoiding taking God's call. And we have to end up admitting that a lot of it is to do with fear. So tonight, a bit of soul searching is required, but I hope that we're going to be encouraged to confront those fears tonight. Because we're looking at a character in Gideon, who had exactly that fear, for very good reason. And yet, by looking at his story, we can find some very practical ways that we can allow God to use us, despite our weakness, despite the fact that we quite simply are afraid. And as a result, God can achieve his purposes through us. So I'm quite confident tonight that if we take these steps, that we can move forward. So we're looking at the character of Gideon. And when I read his story, you read it, it's across three chapters in Judges, from Judges 6. And when I read his story, you may well know bits of it, there were three particular lessons that I took away, so I thought I might as well share them with you tonight. So the first one, if we can have the next slide up. The first one, identify and acknowledge that we are afraid in the first place. Now Gideon, when we join him in the story, he's part of a society that is living in fear, because when we're first introduced to him, he's actually hiding at the beginning of chapter 6. He's hiding in a small pit in the ground where he was actually trying to discreetly thresh wheat so that no one would see it, because they knew that everything they were doing as a people was taken away by their oppressors at that time, so they had to do everything hidden away. They were living in fear as society. Gideon was part of the Old Testament people who many years earlier had been rescued from slavery and then gone through cycle after cycle of rejecting God, being restored, rejecting God, being restored. Gideon was part of a community that had rejected God and they'd turned to worshipping idols. And as a result, that had led to them being living in fear. But what we can learn from Gideon through these three chapters in Judges is firstly that he's honest with God. In a passage in chapter 6, Gideon tells a messenger who'd been sent by God to speak to him. He says, "Where have you been?" Gideon immediately starts questioning God. "We've been living in oppression. I no longer believe you've got the powers that I've read about." Gideon feels let down. He doesn't know who to trust, and it leads to fear. If we think about the origins of fear, we can see right back to the beginning of the Bible in Genesis, because there was no fear in the beginning. And God created this beautiful, perfect world But we, as humankind, chose something different. And it's represented in the pictures of Genesis as the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the apple that Adam and Eve chose to taste. And humankind chose to take control away from God. And as a result of that, that's when sin entered the world. And that was when fear first surfaced, pictured by Adam and Eve, hiding from God. Fear is a consequence of us living in a fallen world. It's not how God wants us to live. But we know we live in a sinful world now, and therefore it's no wonder that we live with fear around us. It's sadly inevitable. We know we too are sinful, and just like the Israelites in Gideon's time, who'd become deliberately sinful and they were now worshipping idols, well, they'd given up on God. It was their sin that led to this. However, Gideon is willing to admit this to God. Fear is part of our world. We can deny that it's going on, and a bit like Gideon, we might hide it away, we might be living in a hole. We can do something. We can hide away, our fear, just like that picture. But time and time again in these chapters, Gideon is afraid. And when he's told by God to destroy these idols that his people had created, he does it under the cover of darkness because he's worried that people might see him. However, the main bit of the story that we had part read today was that Gideon was called by God to lead an army of men to take back their land because it had become taken over by a foreign army. And that would be scary enough in itself, because we get the idea that there's well over 100,000 in this oppressive force. Gideon just has 30,000 men to call upon. So, already it feels pretty unfair. But God intervenes, and basically the number comes down from initially 30,000 in Gideon's force down to 10,000, but then, through this extraordinarily bizarre story, down to just 300 men. So remember, there's over 100,000. God calls Gideon to lead just 300 men. This is ridiculous. And Gideon has said himself that he comes from the weakest tribe and is the weakest amongst them. So I think he's probably got every reason to be fairly skeptical that he's going to be able to achieve this with just 300 men. And I think it puts some of our fears into perspective. Gideon's army taking on this camp, I guess it's a bit like me trying to beat Usain Bolt in a 100-meter sprint, or my 3-year-old son winning the Tour de France on his balance bike. This is a significant task for Gideon. He's got good reason to be afraid. And, we may well also have good reasons to be fearful. However, we see as this story unfolds how his simple acknowledgement of his fact and his willingness to own up to God, how this ultimately leads to God's purposes being achieved. So the first learning for us is to admit and acknowledge our fear. And maybe we need to do that even to ourselves, because it could easily be something that hidden away that we just don't confront. And you know that you've been challenged to speak to that neighbor and tell them about your faith, or there's something going on at your workplace which is wrong and you need to be willing to make a stand, or you've been called to give away your money in some particular way. You're simply worried what will happen if you do, so you hide it away. But let's learn from Gideon. Let's be honest with ourselves and with God, and we know he listens. We know he welcomes us to be honest with him. And if we do want God's will to be done through us, it's the crucial first step to making that happen. Step two, seek and listen to God and then worship him. So we've acknowledged our fear. What next? What else can we learn from Gideon? Well, we see it's not just enough simply to tell God, but Gideon seeks and listens to him and then he worships. Time and time and again in the story of Gideon, a feature of his life is seeking reassurance from God. Early in chapter 6, he asks God, "How can I trust you?" And he requests a sign. Basically, what happens is Gideon's told to prepare a meal, and he goes to a lot of trouble preparing this meal. It's a goat or something, and he prepares it to God, and immediately it's consumed by a huge ball of fire. And it's a clear demonstration of God's power. And then, maybe more famously, God twice answers Gideon with the fleece test. That's in chapter 6 as well. And you do occasionally hear the phrase, "laying out my fleece." And this is where it comes from. But where Gideon leaves out a woolly fleece overnight, he asks God to make it wet by the morning whilst leaving all the ground around it dry. And then when God does that, he's not reassured enough, so he leaves it out again, and this time he asks for the fleece to remain dry while all the ground around it is covered in dew. Now, at first, the fact, you know, that Gideon's constantly asking for signs and reassurance, you know, it seems to almost demonstrate how weak Gideon's trust is in God, that he needs these signs to prove it's genuinely him. But I'm sure that doubt is not something that's alien to most of us, and we can probably relate to Gideon quite easily. But what do we make of this? Well, always with the Old Testament, I find helpful to look at the principles that we can take. And for me, this is really about Gideon seeking to hear from God. Early on, Gideon is reminded by God that he is the one same true God who rescued his people from Egypt. He's reminded of what God has done and the promises made by God to his people. God answers Gideon by reminding him of what has gone before. And it may feel like you do seek signs from God, and sometimes they just don't appear to happen. However, we now live in an age where we have the most amazing sign, which answers our question even better than these signs from Gideon. After God had responded to Gideon, he declares, "Peace, do not be afraid." And we know Jesus also came to bring peace. God's Son was the Prince of Peace. Jesus is coming as man to walk this planet. And with the most extraordinary sign, a sign of God's Son willing to die on a cross, to take all that the world could throw at him, and die so that we could too be free of the punishment that we deserve. And the sign is not left there. We know that there's the sign of the empty tomb. Jesus didn't stay dead, but was restored and is alive. So we have the most extraordinary sign. And we too can be reassured, like Gideon, to know God's peace as a result. So in the story of Gideon that we had read earlier, we have Gideon and his 300 men, and they're meant to be defeating this army so huge that they're described as being so numerous they're impossible to count. Now God knows Gideon well. God knows that Gideon's just like us, that he needs lots of reassurance. He knows Gideon remains fearful despite all these signs that God has already shown him. And to be honest, I think in Gideon's case, fair enough. In chapter 7, just after the bit we had read to us, God speaks to Gideon in verse 10 and asks him if he's afraid, which is a bit of a silly question, because God, I think, knows the answer. Of course he is. Well, God then goes on to deliver definitive proof that his quest will be successful, because Gideon and his servant actually go into that camp undercover, and they overhear someone's dream and its interpretation, which is basically saying this chap called Gideon's going to come and defeat the camp. It's pretty conclusive proof, as proof goes. So from this, I think we need to be willing also to hear from God. And we know that one of the best ways of doing this is by looking at what God has promised us, what is already achieved in our lives. We can do this by looking at the cross and the empty tomb. We know we follow a God who can overcome death. We know we follow a God who loves us so much. He sent his Son to take our punishment. And we can access God directly, we can seek him, be reassured just like Gideon was, and then worship him. We know that when Gideon experienced these signs, that God was there, that it was really him, that Gideon worshipped God. You know, I was talking about that meal that got consumed by a fire as a sign of God's presence. Well, after that incident, Gideon built an altar to God at that very site. And in the story we heard tonight, we see that Gideon, further on in verse 15, he bowed down and he worshipped God after he'd received this sign from him to bring praise to our God. So we seek, we hear, and we worship God. So the first step was acknowledge that we're afraid, tell God. And secondly, we seek, hear, we're reminded of God's power and promises, and then we worship him. And then thirdly, the third key point is that we then act in God's power and in his name. So the third point, we follow what God has asked us to do, but with two key and vital principles. Firstly, that we do it in God's power, and secondly, that we do it in God's name. So we've got these 300 men against this huge group of people. What happens? Well, you may well know, I'm sure you do, but I'd forgotten until I read it. So just in case you have, I'll tell you. God tells Gideon to take trumpets, which were probably likely to have been ram's horns, jars and torches. So he's got his 300 men, and he equips them with trumpets, jars and torches, which I'm sure they found very reassuring about to go into battle. What Gideon and these 300 men do is that they split up and they surround this camp. And when it's particularly dark and everyone is asleep, they start blowing their trumpets and smashing the jars, and they wave their torches about. And you see, an army in those days would have always had trumpets at the front of them, but they probably wouldn't have had 300 trumpets. So suddenly to have heard that many trumpets would have been pretty scary. They'd have assumed that this huge army was around them. And when they start hearing the smashing of clay jars, they start to hear destruction. And when they see torches surrounding them in all directions, again, they'd immediately have thought they were surrounded by this huge army. And what happened was there was complete chaos. The camp started turning on each other, and people were running away, attacking each other. And anyway, basically, the camp is won back by the 300. It's quite some story. The key thing with dealing with these sorts of passages is that they can seem to become just about the individual, or they can become about the death and the destruction that we see. And I think that would be missing the key points here. Because what we see is that Gideon follows God's commands. Despite his initial fear, he acts on it. He doesn't ignore it or hope it goes away. He doesn't remain hidden down a pit. But how did he achieve this? Well, we read in chapter 6, verse 34, that the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon so that he would act in power on God's request. He acted in God's power. The strength came from God, and it came from the Spirit of the Lord. We know that Jesus performed extraordinary miracles and would clearly state this was done by the Spirit of God. And we know that we too have the offer of the Holy Spirit, which will similarly give us the power of God, the strength to achieve. In Acts chapter 5, we're told that the Spirit is given to those who obey God. Even when it seems so unlikely, 300 against 120,000 men, we can tap into that same power. His Spirit can overcome all things if we allow it to, and it's according to God's will. And although that's really exciting, that makes me really scared again. Because it makes me scared because I realize that I I reason away God's call on me. I can make excuses. I can argue back that surely God doesn't want me to talk to that person, to perform that task, to live in that sacrificial way, because it just surely wouldn't work. But if we're absolutely sure it is God we've heard from, and we've been through those steps 1 and 2 I talked about, then we don't have that excuse anymore. But we then need to go back to the step 1, step 2, because we're scared again. And that's why we can seek constantly, or try to seek, reassurance, which is exactly what Gideon is doing in this story. And although at first it looks that he's so weak because he keeps asking and going back to God, it's actually just this, it's just like us. There's another important point to make from this, because if we're going to achieve great things in God's spirit, God is very clear that it's not about us becoming the hero of the story. And interestingly, after Gideon had won this incredible victory, his people wanted him to become king, because, you know, he'd just won with just 300 men. But he refuses, and he says, God is my king. He doesn't want the glory. And we saw in the verses that are read to us tonight, in verse 2 of chapter 7, that God explains why Gideon has to take just 300 men. And it is so that it's clear that it's God who's achieved the victory, not the strength of a particular human or a group of humans. It's in God's name that we act. It's for God's glory that we act. And this is so important, because we can constantly fall into the trap of letting it become all about us for our own glory and fame. God is my king, says Gideon. We need to be sure we can say the same thing. So, if we can have the final slide, Olivia. Oops. Just to be reminded that first off, examining our hearts. What has God been prompting us to do that we've hidden away? What have we been so afraid of? We need to see if there is anything, and if there is, to acknowledge it to God. Then we need to seek him, to be reminded of his promises, to hear from him, and to bring him worship and praise. And then third, if we know it is from God, we need to act on it, to follow his commands, and to do it in God's strength, by his Spirit, and in God's name, because we act in order to build God's kingdom and to bring glory to God. And it doesn't mean that nothing bad then happens. Gideon, actually in this story, he lost his own brothers in this exchange. It won't mean that it's easy. Just like when Peter stepped out of the boat to walk to Jesus in the New Testament story, he started sinking when he looked down. And we may and we will make mistakes, and we'll face new challenges. But we are reminded that God ultimately wants peace to rule in our lives and in our community. We do not need to be afraid. So let's take some time to see how that's true in our own lives.
As the worship band come forwards.